pleasure to introduce our main speaker, Clancy I from Los Angeles, California.
Thank you. Thank you. My name is Clancy Imislin, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm glad to be here again for this anniversary, seventh anniversary. I guess I've been here at all the anniversaries, and I always enjoy being here. The meeting keeps moving. Maybe this year you can pay your rent. But it's always a pleasure to see old friends and new friends. I know if you're new, you may wonder what all this is about, being such a hoorah and reading those interminable traditions and what's the big deal about staying sober, because a lot of people stay sober. And it's always kind of interesting to stop and think that I know I sat in AA meetings again and again, bored out of my wits with their nonsense, and would drink again and drank again and drank again. I did that for almost 10 years. And I know that philosophy very well. I came as kind of a high bottom drunk. Then after a while, I became a medium bottom drunk. Then the last day I drank, two big guys threw me out of a Skid Row mission in Los Angeles and said, "And stay out of here, you bastard." And I drank some, I'm not a bastard. 3 years ago, I was on the faculty of the University of Texas. Ads that I helped write, the El Cid Almaraz for the Borden Company years ago, they were running that very week in Life and Time and Severing Post, New Yorker. I've had my picture in the New York Times for one of my achievements. But it's really hard to explain these things in midair. And I stood outside of that old stinking mission in the cold rain, and I had a terrible feeling. I didn't know what the feeling was. I know what it is now because I've sponsored people who have had it. But it's the feeling of suddenly realizing there's no friendly direction. There's no place to go back to. There's no place where somebody's going to be glad to see you. You are really an island unto yourself. And I stood in that rain. I thought, what am I going to do? If some old guy would have come up to me that morning and said, "You know, Slim, you're dying. You're down to 120-some pounds. You've lost your wife and children and never see them again. You've lost your career." Now I've lost my place and I'll have to start over. My name is Clancy Imislin and I'm an alcoholic. No, that's the way I was when I was younger and children bothered me. But now that I'm a great-grandfather, I just say, ha, ha, ha. Must be a wonderful little tyke. But this guy might have said to me, "You know, once upon a time they called you a boy genius once upon a time. Now you can't even get a job washing dishes." He said, "You've lost everything you own. You had when you were run out of Texas, a guy gave you a drive to Los Angeles, a car to drive to Los Angeles, and you got drunk and lost the car in Phoenix. And that's where you never found the car again, all your personal possessions, all your clothes, all your ID. And that's where they're getting a beef that night with the cop, and they threw you in jail overnight. And that's where in the middle of the night, that hot jail, you got so sick and you threw up accidentally on somebody's bunk and then lay down on the floor and went to sleep. And the guy came back and found his bunk full of vomit and a drunken fool on the floor. And you damn fool. I probably didn't mean to do it, but kicked out your front teeth. That's why you have no front teeth. That's why your mouth is bleeding." And he might have said, "You know, you're an only child and your little mother up in Wisconsin is no longer allowed to accept phone calls from you because your stepfather's so tired of watching you play on her emotions, so she'll go down to her tiny little bank account and take out a few more dollars and send it to her little boy and see if that'll help him. And he'd rather have you think you're dead than the way you are." And he might have said, "You've been sitting in AA meetings off and on for almost 10 years now, and you sit and smirk and think, how long is the heat going to be on? You have to keep going to these damn meetings, they're damn old nonsense. And now you're dying," he might have said. And he might have said, "Why don't you go back to AA one more time and admit you're an alcoholic and see what happens?" And if some guy had said that to me that morning, and if I were in a mood to be honest, which I may or may not have been, I'd have had to tell him, "Pal, you don't understand. I'm not an alcoholic. I wish I were. I wish my life would be so much more simple if my problem was alcohol. But my life, I know there's something wrong with me. I've known that since I was a little boy. It seems to me when I was a little boy, I always had the feeling there's something missing in me. I don't know what it is. But I know when people like me at a distance, but up close, they don't seem to like me so well. They see something in me that I don't know what it is. And I always thought, when I grow up, I'll outgrow this. And I grew up, and it's almost as though when I was a kid thinking, people are supposed to feel like this inside. And I kind of feel like this all the time inside for one reason or another. And it's discomfort and unpleasant. And I thought, when I grew up, it's going to be different. And I grew up, and it was different in some ways. I had different reasons, different understandings. But I still felt that way. And I spent thousands of dollars in psychoanalysis because I became somewhat successful as a writer. And I had some money. And I discovered all sorts of things. I didn't realize I'd been hurt so much. And I really liked psychoanalysis. People say you shouldn't go to psychoanalysis. I liked it. And I always felt better after every session. And it wasn't for 25 years later I understood why. About 30 years ago, I had a guy I sponsored who came to me and he told me about a new group he belonged to called Adult Children of Alcoholics. And at that time, I'd never heard of it. I said, what the hell's that about? He says, well, why don't you come to a couple of meetings with me? So I went to a couple of meetings with him, and in the middle of the second meeting, it suddenly struck me. This is what psychoanalysis did for me. This is why I liked it. It was a great thing. Because what psychoanalysis did, what they intended to or not, and adult children of alcoholics do, they have a solution to a very deep problem. And that problem is long-term and intense, deep-seated guilt. I don't know any emotion that's more painful than deep-seated guilt. And that's what eventually, not only the guilt of the big things that seem so dramatic, but all the little things, the crappy things, the things you should have done and didn't do, the sins of omission. And it's just, what do you think of things that make you crazy? And I know of no way to get rid of them. When I get drunk, they go away for a while, but they come back again. Now, what do you think of a philosophy or a treatment which adult children of alcoholics had and psychotherapy that gets rid of that feeling? Do you know how they do it? The patient becomes convinced that he or she is and has always been a victim. I have been hurt. When I needed love, they didn't give it to me. There was coldness and whatever. You could just on and on, all the things. We all can look back in our lives and think, God, I could have been something. I always think that the epitome of this is the movie On the Waterfront, where the guy sits in the back of his car and says to his brother, you should have taken care of me, Jimmy. I could have been a contender. And we all know that feeling. I could have been something. And you say, how does guilt get rid of that? Or how does that get rid of guilt, I should say? Because it becomes, as you go through the treatment, it becomes more and more apparent that it's their fault. They made me this way. I can't feel guilty of what they've done to me. And the guilt gradually dissipates. And it really is great. I'm going out of the treatment. Boy, come on. Boy, I'm sure glad to know that I was hurt by the depression. Didn't even know there'd been a depression, but now I can see it. Yeah. Stop and have a couple drinks over that. And you think, well, maybe that's fine to get rid of this feeling. That's great. And maybe it is for most people. But I'll tell you something. Nothing is ever free in the world. Nothing is ever free. There's always some little price tag hidden somewhere. And there's two pretty big price tags for victimization, but you only see them in retrospect. One is that whether you intend to or not, you set up, you sustain, and enhance resentment. Resentment to the people who failed you, resentment to the situations where it didn't work out, resentment. If you sit in an ACA meeting, there's no laughter in those meetings. It is comparative resentments. And then the other thing that you have to accept is the other price tag is that you must accept the fact that you've been made different and you're going to stay different. I heard one of the gurus say one time, we're like trees, and when we were saplings, someone reached within us and ripped out our soul. We continue to grow and we look like trees, but inside we are empty. And you may think to yourself, well, maybe it's worth it to maybe it's worth it to have get rid of guilt, to have those things. You know, they're inconveniences, but guilt is a terrible thing. And maybe they are for most people. But when you get here and you stay here a while, you might be startled to learn the two significant causes of alcoholic demise: resentment and feelings of difference. And great many people here have had unhappy childhoods or bad things happen to them. But the great thing about Alcoholics Anonymous that I never knew until it happened to me is that if you do these things long enough, the day comes when you can say, that was terrible, but that was then, and this is now. I remember calling, after that meeting, I called up a friend of mine, Dr. Bob, one of our co-founders, his son. I called him up and said, I've been to this thing called Adult Children of Alcoholics, Bob. I suppose you're going to be president. You're the original adult child of an alcoholic. And I thought that was cute, and he apparently had heard about that before. He was quite testy. He said, no, I do not choose to spend the rest of my life playing out the role of a wounded 16-year-old neurotic. And I said, oh, well, see you around, Bob. Yeah. But that's really the way it is. That's what's so bad about that. And it's so easy to slip into victimization, because when you get what they've done to me. But the great thing here is that you become predetermined. I mean, you predetermine your life yourself. And I stood in that street corner, nobody talked to me, and one day, later that same day in the rain, I knew I had to get out of the rain, I was going to die, I felt. And if you're going to be a long-term slipper, let me give you some hope. Whenever you get so bad that you can't even, nobody can stand you, you can always go to an AA club. That's the only place in the world where the worse you look, the better they like it. Look at this one, Jim, he's mine. And so I found out where the AA club was, and he said, go up to this corner and turn over to Wilshire and walk west. I didn't think about Los Angeles. And I did that, and I went off. And some years later, I measured that in my car. It was about 7.5 miles. That's a long way to walk in the rain, and you're cold, and you're sick, and my mouth bleeding, walking up Wilshire Boulevard, all these fancy stores, and see people going by in their big cars and pointing at me and laughing. And I think it's... And got to this club, and another club with the same old crap on the wall. Live and let live. First things first. My favorite, think, think, think. You do that just before you commit suicide. These wonderful steps over there, these wonderful traditions. I had no idea that'd be my last stop. I really thought I was going to die, and I went in there, and I hung around, and I tried to stay out of sight, and that night there was a meeting, and they served cake, and I had about 4 pounds of cake like we had tonight, because I could chew that. And then they had a meeting on gratitude, and I had to keep from puking it up again. Then everybody went home. It's still raining. I'm standing there. Just the manager of the club and I are left. I said, I better put on my newcomer look. I'm in trouble here. I'm a newcomer. And I have no place to go, and it's raining, and I'm very sick. Could you help me? He said, you're in luck, kid. A guy named Joe Quinn from Laguna Beach left a 49 Merc in the parking lot last summer. Doesn't run, but it's just dry. You can sleep in that. And you want me to sleep in the abandoned car? He said, good idea, huh? Good deal? Yeah, awful. But I remember sleeping in that car that night, still with thoughts in my mind, how can I be here? I used to be something. When I talked, people listened, and now I'm just a bum on the street. And got up early the next morning, because they opened up the club early. They went in there, and they had some kind of meeting at 9 o'clock, spiritual meeting, it turned out. I didn't know that. I had about 4 pounds of cake and went to the spiritual meeting. They talked about God, and I lasted as long as I could, and I slithered out the back. And just went out like this. And the guy told me, he says, you know, you're not supposed to come in here unless you're a member of the club, but you're such a mess, you can come in. But you have to, can't ask anybody for money. Don't be a smart aleck. And every night you have to go to a meeting in the club. And I did that. And I hated it. And I resented it because it just kept ready. when it stops raining, I'm going to be out of here like a flash. But I had no place to go. And I had no idea that that would be my sobriety date. I didn't want it to be. I didn't want to be sober. Being sober to me, when you're not an alcoholic, being sober is not a good thing. Because to me, alcohol is the only thing I ever found. I did spend money in psychoanalysis, read books, did all sorts of things. But when I was 15 years old, I ran away from home early in the Second World War, and I got on a ship in Pearl Harbor, and some guys made me try some alcohol, and I didn't want to do it, but I did it, and I threw up. They laughed, so I kept trying it. I finally held one down, and that day I discovered how to get rid of that scale and how to fill. Alcohol always made me feel like I'm something. I've often thought, you know, you want to test to see if a person is really an alcoholic. Here's a test. Sober them up, keep them sober for a week, and then give them a drink. And if they go, oh, join the club. Because it's got to make that difference. I know it probably sounds terrible to new people, but alcohol is the best friend I ever had. I never had a better friend than alcohol. Friends come and go, lovers come and go, jobs come and go. Cities come and go, states come and go, but a few drinks, what is making the difference that you have to make inside of you, no matter where you are or how, it's just wonderful. And the only problem I ever had is I seem to have a tendency to drink a little too much sometimes, or as I prefer to think, as my psychiatrist told me, I have many times been thoughtlessly overserved. And then I become a bit bizarre and I get in trouble. So I was sent to my first AA meeting a long time ago. Went a small town AA meeting, eight fat guys sitting around a table. They said, what the hell are you supposed to be? And I didn't realize why they were so upset. I know now because there wasn't anybody in that state under 40 in AA and I was 22. And I thought, it's like somebody 12 coming in here now saying, I think I need the program. Is that what you think? You know. Oh, I would actually hit him, I'd pull it, you know. But I sat there for a few days. I heard about, you know, I identify the alcohol, new people. I knew it doesn't take long to discover what AA is. AA is designed to help alcoholics who are alcoholics. People who drink too much, they finally come to AA and admit their problem is alcohol. They return to God, and they live happily ever after. And that isn't me. Alcohol, I've tried getting sober and staying sober, and it's just, it goes to hell inside of me. Alcohol is something I got to do. I remember listening to somebody read chapter 3 many, many years ago, and I thought, God, that's even more stupid than chapter 5. That's really a stupid chapter. And I read the book. My sponsors had wanted me to read the book, so I read the book, and I thought, they say it's a badly written book. It isn't a badly written book. It's just terminally dull. It just never gets anywhere, you know. And you read and read, and you find, now this is going to be it. If you're thorough at this stage of your development. I need action. Some years later, when I came off Skid Row, and my new sponsor had me read the book, do you know what I discovered? It was even duller than I remembered. But to me, alcohol is something I have to... I heard chapter 3 read. I mean, chapter 3, right, as they do in some meetings. And it wasn't allowed sober this time 4 or 5 years. In some meetings in Southern California, they read chapter 3. And I sit there one night, you know, when they read chapter 5 or chapter 3, as we all know, we hate it, but it's true. Your mind wanders off sometimes. Rarely have a seen person fail. And, no more, no more. I wonder if I should call that guy or not. And God could and would have sought. That's just because we're human beings and they're a dreadful bunch. But I somehow that night I was not feeling well or something. I was listening to chapter 3. And all of a sudden it suddenly struck me. My God, that's the story of my life. And so it could be autobiographical. And if you're new tonight, as you look around this room, they say, well, you're home now. I'm not home. What have I got in common with all these boobs? You know, different sizes and shapes and colors and ages and all got different drinking stories and all got different backgrounds. And I got nothing in common with these people. Well, you do. Because it turns out people like us, let me go back one more step and say, there seems to be types of alcoholics. There's a type of alcoholic, apparently, who, when faced with tremendous crisis, loss of a job, loss of a family, death in the family, they quit and they never drink again. These same people come onto treatment centers and they quit and they never drink again. I know a number of people like that. There's a big hospital up in Seattle called Sheikh Shadel, and they advertise, we will cure your alcoholism in 30 days. And we think that's stupid, but they got all the names on the wall. But there's another type of alcoholic who seems to be an alcoholic as much as those people, and something happens that really threatens their security. They lose a family or lose a job or somebody dies, and they quit. But they always eventually drink again. And the same type of people come out of treatment centers with tears rolling down their cheeks. Sincere, but they always drink again. And these are the type of drinkers that have puzzled humanity for at least 4,000 years in written history. For hundreds and thousands of years, people have looked at these people and said, what is wrong with you? At one time, they thought they were possessed by devils. They put them to death. They flog them and put them away. And even in our lifetime, in my lifetime, they still had never found an answer for it. Never found an answer for it. And this type of alcoholic is, you know, most of us aren't familiar with the scientific efforts to help us, but we can see it. I'm sure if you had the same experience I've had of watching somebody who loves you with that terrible look of disappointment on their face again and saying, oh, how could you? Look at you. You promised. You were doing better. You were starting to do better. And now look at you, you're drunk. How could you do such a thing? And what's the answer to that? Leave me alone. Because I don't know either. Leave me alone. And these are the people that puzzled everybody. And these are the people that wind up in rooms like this. Because these rooms are designed for people who always drink again. And these rooms are designed, Bill Wilson in his book, Alcoholics Anonymous, talks about this type of alcoholic. He doesn't mention types of alcoholics. He said, our type of alcoholic, our type. What he means is, our type of alcoholic who will drink again. And what's so amazing that people stay sober here. Our birthdays tonight, big deal, 1 year. That's a tremendous achievement for an alcoholic of our type, a year. But how is it brought about? It's brought about somehow here in AA. But how do you bring it about? How do you bring it about? What do I have in common with all these people that if I understand that I could do something? Well, in that chapter 3, they kind of just go through it for a page. They acknowledge that people of our type have something in common. All of us, sooner or later, have to voluntarily or involuntarily accept the obsession that somehow, someday, I will control and enjoy my drinking. He says the persistence of this illusion is astonishing. And that's for people like me and I guess like you. People that find sobriety unbearable and drinking makes it better, but now drinking is a problem. I got to find a way to beat it somehow. And then it goes on to say how we fight the term alcoholic, but occasionally we have brief recoveries. And we've all had brief recoveries, I guess. I had a brief recovery. Remember one of the times I was just thinking, eat before you go out, put some butter in your stomach. That's what you need. It just makes you vomit out your nose, that's all. Having brief recoveries followed always by still worse relapse. And if we didn't still have that relapse, we wouldn't be here tonight. We'd be out doing it well. And then you get to a point that sounds so... It's one of the nicest phrases as a writer, I just admire it. Reaching a stage of pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. Remember, I used to think, God, that's how drunk those poor boobs get. But that isn't what it means at all. That's how you feel after you sober up. And the heat is on. Pitiful and incomprehensible to mourn says, how could you be there? Like, what do you do that for? Leave me alone. That's not much of an answer, but that's what we got. And that's what makes this remarkable organization so strange, that people like me and people like all of them with all those backgrounds have somewhere along the line found a way not to drink when it clinically is necessary for alcoholics of our type to drink. A long time ago, before A even started, one guy went to Europe to a psychiatrist, and the psychiatrist told him, he said, you have to find some sort of, the only sober alcoholics I've ever seen, I've never seen hardly any of them, but the ones I've seen or read about, haven't even seen them, I read about them, have had some involuntary psychological change that they call a spiritual experience. And he didn't know what that meant. He came back and he got in some religious little organization called the Oxford Movement, and he stayed sober, but he didn't know what it meant. But that particular phrase has become a cornerstone of AA, that somehow you have to have a spiritual experience. I doubt if anybody in this room has had it. I've only known maybe three people in my lifetime that I know that I really believe had a spiritual experience. One of them was Bill Wilson when he told me about it. So how can we stay sober without a spiritual experience? And these people were groping at first, and some people were staying sober in the 1930s. Incidentally, talking about anniversaries, the 7th anniversary, and on Sunday, when the intergroup has their business meeting, they may take a moment to sing Happy Birthday to Alcoholics Anonymous. It'll be 72 years old on Sunday. But the... Are you making sounds? This is the signal for sounds. This is choked sobs. But in short, what happened to me in that club in Los Angeles is what happened to all of us here who are sober. Somehow or other, we stayed long enough to begin to overcome the absolute killer defense that kills people like us. It's not even a big thing. It's something we all come here with, I believe. Just the, I know you want to help me, but my case is different. You don't understand. And that doesn't sound like much, but that I'll tell you the result of that. According to the figures from the National Institute of Health about, I guess, 2004, the most recent ones I've heard, it is estimated in America, where there's AA everywhere and treatment centers everywhere and ways to get better everywhere, that alcoholics of our type, our mortality rate is still above 90%. Over 90% of alcoholics like us in America will die as a result of drinking. And if you kind of knew, you know, that this is nice, but maybe we should be in Akron, where it was founded. Akron has the same relationship to AA that Bethlehem has to Christianity. Something nice happened there once, but not for a long time. In America, where people stay sober in pockets of enthusiasm. But the thing that makes AA work is that somehow people get through that wall of my case is different. How do they do that? I'll tell you how it's done. Because there are no psychiatrists here, there are no doctors here, there are no clergymen here. They are, but they're here as alcoholics, not for their trade. And what we have in common, I can maybe, as happened to me, I found myself hearing people talk about feelings that I thought I was the only one in the world that had. And I came to try to trust a little bit of a guy who saved my bacon. And I came to believe he might know how I feel. And it doesn't sound like much, but it saved my life. And it saved the life of everyone. The whole story of Alcoholics Anonymous is unlike any other therapy in the world. This is the only therapy in the world where one drunk talks to another drunk. And the purpose of that talk is to little by little get this guy to maybe momentarily open up his armor. Oh, you know that too? And little by little come to understand you're not so different. But even that in itself is nice, but that won't keep you sober. There has to be some sort of a change in my life that I don't even know what I have to change. And that's what all this talk about the steps are for. The steps don't even seem to make sense to anybody who's got the cursed with the ability to think, you know, I'm going to admit my problem is alcohol, and therefore my life's unmanageable. I'm going to turn my life over to God. He's going to make me sane. Jesus is going to announce, write about it, and read it to some boob that'll babble it all over town. I'm going to ask God to make me perfect, and I'm going to make amends to people who've been screwing me for 30 years. And then I'm going to meditate for a while. If I get through that without committing suicide, I'm going to try to help somebody else. Not what I would call a system of recovery for a man of my sensitivity. And yet, that has changed more lives. That book, that dull book I talked about, has changed more alcoholics of our type in the last 72 years or less, actually 66 years, 67 years, than all other therapies combined in the history of mankind. And we have been given a great advantage over most of the alcoholics in the world. We, without any volition of our own, we have been fortunate enough to be born into an era where that help is available. And it doesn't sound like much, but up until just a few years ago, people like us were just put in hospitals and put in asylums and sent away or kept in the back room. Become a curse of the family. I was like that with the phrase the Irish use for the alcoholism, the curse, the curse. Yes, your dad had the curse, that's why he died. No treatment, no nothing. And it turns out that the problem here, if you could stay here long as we discover, I'm going to oversimplify because we don't have a lot of time. I always knew I couldn't be an alcoholic because my problem wasn't really alcohol. My emotions were out of whack, and alcohol made me feel better. And that's what made it better, and somehow, at the end of that little chapter 3 I was quoting, it talks about what people like us do. We change from one kind of booze to another. Maybe that'll do it. Or I'll just drink beer. Or I'll just drink wine. Or I'll take some physical exercise. Or I'll read spiritual literature. Or I'll take a trip. It gives a whole paragraph of things. And I've tried every one of those things. And sooner or later, they never work because the emotions get to a point where you have to have relief. And if you really hang on, scientists say that people like us can get to a point where you literally must drink to preserve your sanity. And I stayed sober once in Texas because I'd been in jail when my son died, just overnight, but it was the wrong night. And I took a vow in his casket to drink, not to drink, and I stopped drinking then and thereafter. And 2 months later, I was in the Texas State Insane Asylum as a suicide. It just got so bad, I couldn't stand it. Now, people like us can't stay sober. Now, what is going to make us stay sober? These 12 steps, and this fellowship, and being around people, and eventually getting to believe that people know that how you feel, and you're not so different after all, that there's a name for the emotions you have. And it's not alcohol. It is called alcoholism. You might think, what's the difference? Alcoholism, is that some sort of a game? Not at all. An alcohol problem, if you got an alcohol problem, you have to come to these meetings, they'll tell you that. You don't need AA. You shouldn't even waste the time in AA. If your problem is alcohol, here's what you do. You quit drinking and you clean up your act and you're home free. However, apparently you suffer from that thing called alcoholism, which unfortunately for you and me looks almost exactly the same to the naked eye. This mind-consuming, perception-distorting, bodily-eroding thing called alcoholism, you'll discover that stopping drinking and cleaning up your act has no significant long-term effect on your life other than to gradually make it so painful you can't stand it. And you'll know that your case truly is different and nobody understands and nobody can understand. And so it turns out that when the disease is alcoholism, something has to be done, or we must certainly drink again. And what is done is that in Alcoholics Anonymous, all of the forces here of friendship and fellowship and sponsorship is to little by little get me to take actions that I can't see how they can help me at all. And the net result of that is this. They issued this book in 1939, and Bill Wilson wrote in there, having had a spiritual experience as a result of these steps in the 12th step. And his followers went up and said, Bob, you never, Bill, you never experience as a result of the 12 steps? You got in the hospital while you were loaded. And that's right. And they said, there are a couple hundred of them, they said, we can't stay sober if that's what you have to do. And as they waited, they began to gradually discover something that has changed the whole course of what we do here. They discovered that in some way that no one can describe, in some way that nobody can explain, these 10 steps, when taken under guidance, do something that nothing else has ever done in the history of mankind. It brings about an incremental spiritual experience. We don't get it, not the way Bill Wilson got his. Whoom! The way we get ours. Make amends to that bitch, are you crazy? And little by little, you do these things, and what happens is this. My sponsor told me, I said, why do you drink? Why would people drink when it's hurting them so much? He says, they don't drink, it's hurting them. He says, you got to understand what makes an alcoholic. What makes an alcoholic is that it isn't what alcohol does to you at all. It's what alcohol does for you. And he had a Coke in his hand, and he said, when I have a few drinks, it almost instantly alters my perception of reality. When I have a few drinks, it almost instantly changes my relationship to the world around me. When I have a few drinks, it almost instantly makes me taller and more self-contained, and them smaller and less threatening. I said, Jesus, Bob, what's wrong with that? He said, because it isn't really happening, you moron. And I said, then why should people drink when it's going to be like that? He said, that's the other part of the illness. He said, people like us, our emotions are just a little unkempt. And sooner or later, they get to a point where we have to have relief. And relief to people like you and me is a few drinks. So to be an alcoholic, that doesn't mean you drink until you die on Skid Row. You drink till you stay sober, till you drink, till you stay sober, till you drink, till you stay sober. And every time you go back and forth, you say, but my problem isn't alcohol. You don't understand. All that crap you're talking about can't help me. And every one of us have gone through that. And that's why it's necessary to stay here and hopefully find someone that you trust and ask them to help you. And to find a way to do things that you don't necessarily believe in. Because the proof of the pudding is this. This meeting is full of people who cannot stay sober. According to science, any way it's better. This type of alcoholic sooner or later must drink. And left to our own devices, we will. But somehow when we get together and share and help one another, we somehow stay sober. When my sponsor told me that, it was December of 1958, a long time ago. And I thought, my God, I'm an alcoholic. My life didn't get a lot better, but at least I knew it was wrong with me. And little by little, things worked out. I finally held a little job when I was 2 years sober. Still had no front teeth, but I learned to carry my lip like this. They just thought it had been burned in a fire. And my sponsor gave me tips on how to act. And I'd been in big jobs before, but I didn't always get blew up. And when I was 5 years sober, I was director of advertising for that big medical corporation. When I was 7 years sober, another guy and I were brought into Hollywood, and we created the number one hard rock station in the world, something called Boss Radio. We all wore shiny suits and said things like, what's coming on down, baby? When I was 10 years sober, I was downtown doing public relations for an oil company. 15 years sober, I was a marketing director in Beverly Hills. And all because of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's impossible at a time like this to explain each nuance, because we all have little nuances. But what we have in common is that we come here emotionally and spiritually and physically starved many times. And today we're doing better. little by little. Something has happened inside of us. Because it turns out the purpose of Alcoholics Anonymous is not to make you sober and, you know, drier and drier. Christ, I've been sober 48 years. I'm bursting a flame up here. The purpose of Alcoholics Anonymous, I believe, is to do very slowly what alcohol did fast. To change my perception of reality. To change my relationship to the world around me. To little by little make me taller and more self-contained and them less frightening. And the last thing I want to tell you, it's supposed to make you feel different. And it made me feel different. When I was 15 years sober, I resigned a job in Beverly Hills, big job. And for the last 34 years, I run the mission on Skid Row that threw me out in 1958. And people say, why do you want to give up your great career to run this mission on Skid Row? And I can never think of a good answer for that. I said, well, it was such a significant decrease in salary, I couldn't pass it up. I'm still trying to find those two bastards that threw me out. Once I get them, I'll be out of there. But this morning, I did something none of you ever do, and I would never thought I'd want to do it. I live out by the ocean in Los Angeles. I don't live in Skid Row. I live in a nice big house with a big yard and sponsor some people and go to meetings. And last night, I was at a meeting, my home group in West Los Angeles, 1,000 people there every Wednesday night, biggest, most successful group in the world, lively, celebrating our 44th anniversary. But I got up this morning and I got in my car and I drove down through Beverly Hills on the Santa Monica Freeway. My car still liked to get off there and I have to go, when I get it off there. And I got down to Skid Row and I parked my car and walked around the building and stepped over the bodies of men, women, and children dying from alcoholism and drug addiction and bereavement and insanity. And went inside, we spent much of the day trying to figure out how can we get these poor bastards to identify their problem and take him actions they don't believe in. Because nearly all of them will die on that street, and they will not die because there's not an answer. They will die because they refuse to change their actions. And then I quick jumped down in my car and drove to the airport and came here to help celebrate this anniversary. Because of the anniversary of groups like this and other places, and people like you and me, we're all the same down deep. Because I've been sober a long time, I go a lot of places to talk. In the last few years, I've been in Cape Town, South Africa, and Sweden and Norway, and earlier this year I was in London and Dublin and Belfast, and next month I'm going to Berlin and Vienna and all over the Pacific. You'd think you'd really find exotic AA in these places, but you don't. Except for these accents, you hear the same emotions from everybody all over the world. Like us, people like us say, but I don't think you understand. But you see, my case is different. But that couldn't possibly help me, those things. Always, always. And then in the other part of the room are people saying, yes, they do help. Because look, I've been sober 5 years. Let me help you. It's the damnedest thing, trying to get people to save their life. I'll guarantee you one thing. If I walked into a cancer ward tomorrow and said, hey, I got a deal to solve cancer's problems. I can get rid of cancer if you'll take some actions you don't want to take. Will you do it? They would line up and weep and beg. You go into an AIDS ward where I've been, people dying open source, you say, I got an answer for AIDS. Would you go to some meetings and try to help some people? Oh God, yes, I will. But you go to an alcoholic ward and you can't get them to go to a meeting because you don't understand, my liver is out like this. But that's not what's wrong. They don't understand. And the last thing I want to say, you may think, yeah, it's easy for you. You came off Skid Row with your teeth kicked out. But that's not what we have in common. In the last few years, I've had the opportunity to sponsor a lot of people. This noon, I had lunch with the man that put the flag on the moon in 1969. And I sponsor Academy Award-winning directors and actors and workers and lawyers and ditch diggers and guys who can't get a job doing nothing. What do we all have in common? We weren't all thrown out of the midnight mission with our teeth kicked out. We all wound up in life where drinking was important because sobriety was untenable. Nothing will ever change that until I take some actions that will change my perception of reality. And without that, I'll guarantee you drink. Because AA is exactly the same thing tonight at this anniversary, as it was on June 10th, 1935, those guys in Akron, one alcoholic talking to another alcoholic to help him reduce his feelings of difference at least enough so that he will begin to take action he does not yet believe in. And when that moment comes, life begins to change. Happy anniversary.